Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on the Conversation on this Aloha Friday, August 28th. We've got the latest on the storm recovery from Big Island Mayor Kima Alameda. We also hear from residents across the state about their frustrations dealing with the outages caused by the storm. A decision to shutter three centers of the National Archives that hold documents about the Pacific Islands and Native Americans has raised questions about when and why and what happens to the records. We hear of a new project, Preserving Stories of Maui. The Oral History Center at the University of Hawaii has new funding to allow us to share experiences of people in Hawaii Nei. Tuned to the Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we get a progress report to wind up the week following the impact of Hurricane Lala. We got a chance to talk to Big Island Mayor Kima Alameda about an hour ago. He's encouraged that basic services have mostly been restored, but there will be no quick fix at the Nalehu Cemetery, which is a county cemetery where floodwaters unearthed remains. Crews are taking extra precautions as the plan is executed to clear debris without first making sure that any Evie or artifacts aren't impacted. Here's the mayor.
We got our crews out there. Our road crews are cleaning up the debris on these pocket areas on the island. And they did a real good job in cleaning debris for the main arteries and getting back access, especially to the Kau district. So that's really good. Hawaiian Electric Company has done a fantastic job at restoring power. I believe now we're in the hundreds. We were in the thousands not too long ago, and so it's really nice to see. Of course, water now is, you know, everybody has access to water, except in some places they got to go to the spigot to get it, and we're working on that. Our water department's working hard on that as well. So it's these major infrastructure utilities that concern me the most.
Yes, you know, just the basic necessities, so vital for so many. And we understand that, the Department of Education, you know, has a plan for classes resuming.
Yes, they're working with us. I mean, we're more than happy to let them use our gym. The Pahala gym is fairly new. It was created in the Kinoa administration. Super strong. It's a hurricane, I believe, 3 or 5, that kind of a strength. So, you know, they do have rooms. And so we're going to help the Nalehu could handle. I mean, I think they have like about 200 students and faculty that will be situated there for now as they make repairs on the Nalehu school.
And then what can you tell us about the cemetery situation? Because, gosh, the images are just, you know, stunning, just a wall of debris and, you know, headstones and, oh, my gosh. So how are you navigating
that? Oh, man, it's so sad. First, it's very emotional. I mean, it's super sad. You know, I had family out there. And when we did the briefing Wednesday night, you know, I wanted to facilitate it. That's what I do as kind of my skill set, working with large groups and just kind of, you know, getting them to hear us out. And, man, we started off with tears. You know, it's just a super sad situation. It's like a second death for many of these families, you know, and so I feel their pain. But we wanted to let them know our status, right? Be as transparent as possible and let them know that it's going to take a while. There is phases of this. First, we got to make sure we preserve the site, make sure that we can identify, well, collect first, right? Collect every single revered, sacred remain as possible. And not just the remains, but sometimes people are buried with very sacred items, you know, like a wedding ring or a necklace. And so we're finding those as well, and we want to make sure that we connect it to the right, you know, loved one. So we let them know that's the first phase. The second is identification. You know, the third is to reunify the loved ones with their families. And then fourth is simultaneously we got to figure out what we're going to do with the cemetery, you know. That section A is the part that got damaged the most, but there is section B, C, D, and E. And B and C, kind of some tombstones got moved, but we feel like we can preserve those sections. But we're definitely going to have to look at the future of the cemetery.
Yeah, it's such a task. I mean, you know, when I flash back to, what we had to do with Maui wildfires, right? And identifying remains, and we had to bring in, you know, people with special training on identifying, you know, all these different artifacts and bone fragments and that kind of thing. But yeah, we have a better feel on numbers.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have, it's a county cemetery, so, you know, we have a list of the plots, we have names. But, you know, when we did the briefing Wednesday night, you know, there were some family members who said, you know that their names were not on the list. So we do have some work to do in working with each of the families to make sure that our list matches up with what they know. And they're just all kind of questions, you know, like when can the other sections that is preserved, when can it be used? For example, if somebody passes away, God forbid, in the next week or something, and they had a plot in, say, I don't know, section D or E where it's okay, like could they use the site? And our answer is right now, first of all, it's very difficult to get to the site because there's all kind of debris. It's very unsafe. So we recommend nobody go to the site, especially with machinery right now until we give the go ahead. And we're there now making sure that we want to search every single debris for every possible sacred remains, right? Because we owe it to the families to do that. And yeah, so it's going to be a daunting task, but I was so appreciative and grateful and with so much humility that the Kau'u community allowed us to come into the Nalehu gym and share an update, and they were so gracious and kind.
And we were hearing more than 100 graves possibly disturbed?
Yes, about 125 or so. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and it depends on what the families tell us, because like one family said that they actually, a couple of years ago, they resumed their loved one and they moved them to a Pahala, I think it was, a different cemetery. So, you know, it's going to have to start going by a case-by-case basis to talk to the families to get more information from them exactly who's buried and such.
And then do we have a plan, as we start retrieving some of these coffins or caskets, where they'll be or how they'll be stored until we can get them back in the ground again?
Yes, that's a great question. So right now we have cold storage at our Na'alehu police station, a 40-foot container. We're just following the best practices from our anthropologists, you know, and so we collected those remains in a very culturally respectful way. Wrapped them in a tapa kind of box. The Native Hawaiian contingency from Maui, who had some experience with the line of fire, helped us with some cultural protocols. And of course, people from Kau'u, they wanted to participate in that. So they're being stored right now. Every remain is being stored in a cold, climate-controlled environment, secured right there by the police station. And so that's where it's at until we can get the team to come down and help us identify it. And that's where we're going to reach out to the federal government. This is like, we're probably going to have to do DNA tests. It's going to be hard. And so, yeah, so the future, you know, for those remains that we can identify, we can return them back to the families and we can decide how they want to proceed, whether it's burial, cremation, or otherwise. For those that we kind of identify, we may do a memorial of some type where we just include all the names of the loved ones. And that's someplace that folks can go on an annual basis to honor them. So there's different options, and right now we're just kind of leaving it up to the community to help guide us through this process.
Yes, I mean, it's a very, you know, delicate situation, and so many, you know, multi-agencies involved, you know, between the Department of Health, Historic Preservation, you know, counties. But I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the FEMA declaration, does that cover these kinds of needs that we have?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, actually. This is so unprecedented. I was hoping they could, especially on the cemetery, because one of the questions is, like, who's going to pay for the reburial? I mean, our county is already strapped with our wastewater situation. We're in the billion-dollar phase already in terms of the cost of the county for infrastructure needs. And then here we get hit with this major, unprecedented flood of 40 inches of rain in mostly one district. So we're reaching out to the feds and we're asking President Trump and his team to help us. We really need help.
I know there's just the immediate needs that we've got to deal with, and then the long-term plan on, you know, putting things back together again. So many policy issues that will have to be addressed. But is there anything else then that you want to get out to our listeners just about the situation there, you know, boots on the ground?
Sure. I mean, I'd like to, well, first, you know, let the listeners know that I want to thank your listeners for your for their prayers and their good wishes. And I know their hearts are with us. And that helps. And I feel it. And we feel it. We have a great team. We have a team members that actually have families who were buried there. So this hits home directly to us. And, you know, we just want to continue to let the community know that we're doing the best we can with the resources we got. And we're going to continue on this journey with the community, with transparency. And hopefully we end up being stronger than ever. That's my hope and that's my prayer.
And so this next month, what are the priorities then for, you know, recovery?
Yeah, I mean, all kinds. Right now, it's basic needs. We got to get a better understanding of the basic needs. And, you know, if it's housing, then we got to get a list of people who need housing. And we kind of have that already, but we want to make sure we capture the whole island, because the whole island was impacted. Kau was hit the hardest. And then after housing, we want to make sure that we work with the state, because kids got to go to school. And so if we can help with that, and like we are already. So it's kind of getting back to normalcy, you know. If some people lost their jobs or because businesses have been destroyed, there are 8 businesses that were destroyed. That's employment for some folks. We want to address that as well by working with our business communities. So every single aspect that brings us back to normalcy, that's the path to recovery, and we're addressing it one day at a time.
And then, you know, you talked about wastewater. I don't know, you know, how did our systems fare with, you know, the rain and all?
Yeah, that's a great question, because people don't realize that the heavy rains, they go into the wastewater stream. And unbelievably, especially on the Hilo side where the wastewater is a concern, it was able to handle. Our pumps were able to handle it. We didn't have any major disruptions. And that was one of my biggest fears. But there were some private wastewater systems like in Punalu'u that were damaged. And so, you know, the private systems, they're going to have to take a look at that. That's going to be their challenge in bringing those systems up to par.
Okay. And then you say that you're headed to Honolulu. Any other issues that you're trying to address?
Well, I just had a nice talk with the governor. I mean, we were talking a little bit about housing, and he has some ideas, you know, kind of lessons learned from the Lahaina fire, and maybe even some extra units that, you know, that we could put together to address the immediate housing needs of those in Alehu and Wahine.
All right. Okay. Well, safe travels, Mayor, and just keep us posted on the progress.
You do. Thank you, Catherine.
All right. Aloha.
Aloha.
We've just heard from Big Island Mayor Kimo Alameda this morning, just before he was about to jump on a plane to Oahu today.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
HPR is hiring a donor relations officer. The role involves building meaningful relationships with donors and supporting measurable fundraising goals. The position works collaboratively to advance HPR's major and planned giving efforts, to help strengthen donor engagement, and to support the station's long-term financial sustainability. For more information, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from Pa'i Foundation, presenting the Mamo Wearable Art Show and Mahu Madness, September 11th and 12th at Hilton Hawaiian Village. Tickets at paifoundation.org.
I'd like to take a moment and share stories that have come to us over the last few weeks in the wake of Hurricane Lala. Choi wrote in from Hikina Lane in Lower Kalihi on Oahu. We have been without power on the entire block, probably 4 apartment buildings and a handful of homes filled to the brim with people. We feel that our power could have been restored in a few minutes of work and that we've been waiting for days to get back power so that people who already have to wait a week can have their power 30 minutes sooner than they would have. Our fridges are sour, our floors are covered in water from trying to use ice, and we are having little fits and fights about someone using our charger pack to charge their charger pack when it wastes power to move energy from one charger to another. Overall, we do not think our power remains off because it's the best plan for the infrastructure. We think it was a poorly managed response based on making a good look by flexing crews to go wait in a group for heavy equipment to do the work anyway so that it can look good for the management that everyone is at the most spectacular damage. We also heard from Joe, who lives in the Kalihi area as well.
How is it that our leaders are not just in a responsive reactionary space of trying to fix our lines, fix our roads after storms, but one of the conversations I have is enough talk about ahupua'as and Hawaiian values. How about actually acting on them, making our communities more villages, more distributing leadership? Instead of a managerial style that's top-down, we need to create responsiveness among citizens, which means building social relationships. Capitalism loves us on our cell phones, on our media, but face-to-face relationships are in deep decline because capitalism favors the individual. It does nothing to support the family or the community. It's all about individual maximization of profit. So to get out of this, Hawaii needs an actual serious conversation about Hawaiian values and a return to a more distributed form of living. Thank you.
Meanwhile, on the Big Island, Lynn Gordon checked in from Ocean View.
People here have come together. We didn't have help from the county at all. And I want to let you know that Waihino is further south on the way to Na'ale, who is the poorest area in the whole island of Hawaii here. So anything that anybody can do to help us, we will be so grateful. There are so many people who just live on bagged ice and are really just minimally getting by. So whatever anybody can do, the county, come help us. I know they're helping Waihino and Na'alehu because they were hit very bad too. So I kind of feel like we're children to be taken care of last. But you know, we were great that our community came together to help each other. Thank you, Polly, for the ice and the fish and everybody else that contributed food 2 days ago. We are so grateful for all that we have. We may not have it all together, but together we have it all. Aloha.
I like that. We may not have it all together, but together we have it all. And finally, Kristen McCormick with the Red Roads Resilience Network sent this in about the community of Puna's recovery.
Aloha. This is Kristen from the Red Road Resilience Network here in Lower Puna. We're coming up on almost 2 weeks now since Lala, and our community is still recovering. Power is back on for most people now, thankfully, but many of our neighbors went a week, even 10 days without it, and some still don't have it back. And that's really hard. Especially in a rural community like ours, where losing power can also mean losing refrigeration, internet, cell service, and the ability to pump catchment water and run UV filtration for safe drinking water. So when that goes on for days and days, you really do need each other. You need neighbors helping neighbors and local resilience hubs and organizations getting water and ice and food and other supplies close to where people actually live. And we didn't even face the worst of the storm. We know communities in Kau and Pahala were hit so much harder. So it's definitely been a learning experience for all of us. Right after the storm, our volunteers and neighbors were doing welfare checks and driving through neighborhoods checking for damage. Chainsaw crews cleared main roads and then moved into smaller roads and private driveways. They were just volunteering. It was really cool to see that level of our community organize, and people figured out what needed to happen, what they had to offer, and they showed up. but we also saw the gaps. With power and cell service down, we were still hearing days later, sometimes through just word of mouth, about people stuck behind fallen trees. They didn't have a chainsaw and sometimes had no way to even get the word out that they needed support. At the same time, there was this incredible wave of generosity. One of my favorite examples was a freezer gleaning effort right after the storm. So instead of letting good food spoil during the outages, neighbors donated it, and volunteers collected it, and local cooks got really creative. The Space Resilience Hub down the road hosted a community meal with that food and fed more than 100 people. And because space is an off-grid facility, people could also charge their phones and refill water bottles and get online and just connect with each other. And that kind of sharing continued. Local farms have been donating more food. Volunteers gleaned and cooked and delivered meals. Water and ice came into our area through Vibrant Hawaii and was distributed locally with the help of volunteers and community partners. So we're really grateful to Vibrant Hawaii and the Pahoa Resilience Hub for helping connect us with resources and opportunities that helped our community recover more quickly. We're pretty far down here at the end of the road, and so those connections really do matter. It takes a network to get resources from up there to down here, and then from a community hub out to the neighbor who actually needs it. And now, almost 2 weeks later, I think something else has changed too. We know our neighbors a little better. We know who down the road is off-grid and has solar, who might have some refrigerator space to share, or a hot shower, clean drinking water, or a place to charge a phone. We know which neighbor got power back first, and maybe just how long of an extension cord it takes to reach their house. And we know who has a chainsaw or a truck, and who might need a check-in, and who we can call when somebody needs a hand. Those might seem like little things, but I think that's what community resilience actually looks like. Vibrant Hawaii has helped support and champion something we've wanted to build down here for a long time, a network of local resilience volunteers and hubs who know their neighborhoods, know what skills and resources are around them, and can help connect people when something happens. Lala gave us a chance to see that network really come alive. And it also showed us where we still have work to do. One of the things that has really touched me is that even while our own community was recovering, people here were asking, hey, what does Kau need? What can we send to Pahala? So supplies and donations started moving outward too, so many of them. And that's been really beautiful to see. Community taking care of community. And nearly 2 weeks later, that work hasn't stopped. We're still helping each other recover. We're still sharing food and resources. And now we're also starting to come together and talk about what we learned. We have another community gathering happening this week around a shared meal. And really, the important part is the conversation. What worked? What was hard? Where did we struggle? What surprised us? And what did we learn that we'd want to do differently next time? And how do we stay connected to each other now instead of waiting until the next emergency to figure out who our neighbors are? Because it really isn't if something like this happens again, but when. And I think that's the biggest lesson for us. Resilience isn't just how much food and water we have stored up. It's knowing who lives down the road and who might need some help, who has something to offer, and knowing how to find each other when we need one another. That's what we want to keep building along our red road down here. So whatever comes next, we're more connected, more prepared, and better able to get through it together and come out stronger. Mahalo to Hawaii Public Radio for giving us a moment to share a little bit about this amazing community and all the ways people have shown up for one another. We hope everyone across the island continues to recover well. And wherever you live, I hope you find and build those connections with the people around you now, so they're there when you really need them. Mahalo.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, focused on local innovation, decarbonization, and investing in renewable and locally sourced energy solutions. Learn more at hawaiigas.com.
A study out from UCLA looks at how immigration raids impact small businesses and the communities they serve.
Key commercial corridors in the city turn into ghost towns almost kind of overnight, and they've had that lasting effect.
I'm Kristen Schwab. How immigration policy changes local economies. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, after All Things Considered.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, offering fresh roasted 100% Hawaiian coffee subscriptions delivered from their Hilo Roastery. More at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com.
The Trump administration recently announced plans to close 3 regional National Archive facilities. One of these is the NARA San Francisco Archives, which contains thousands of documents about Hawaii, American Samoa, and the Native American communities of the West Coast. These records are regularly used by scholars for genealogical, military, and immigration-related research. It is one of the most comprehensive collections of Pacific archives, making it one of the few ways academics can get a snapshot of what Hawaii was like during the territorial period. Professor Maile Arvin of the University of Hawaii at Manoa campus and Professor David Iona Chang have co-organized a letter opposing the closure of NARA San Francisco. Our intern, Addis Belai, sat down with them to discuss how this closure will affect Native Hawaiian research. Chang starts us off by explaining why the San Francisco location matters most to our islands.
The National Archives is the federal agency that's in charge of getting the public access to records that were generated by the federal government. They have a central archive, but they have a number of regional archives as well. One of the most important ones for us as people who are connected to Hawaii, as Kanaka, but also for anybody connected to Hawaii or American Samoa, is the National Archives Record Center, which is in San Francisco. And so they say they're going to close that and they're going to move the records to an undisclosed location with undisclosed access protocols. And so that's what's going to close. The timeline on it is not, I don't know, Maile, do you know a timeline on this stuff?
Yeah. No, it's also undisclosed, I believe. I'm not sure exactly how it was that a lot of Hawaii records ended up there, but whether it was intentional or not, it is the closest regional archive to Hawaii in American Samoa. And there are a lot of really long established communities of diasporic Hawaiians and Samoans in the San Francisco Bay Area. Therefore, it's really important to keep this regional archive that is the closest to us, to our communities, open to ensure access. And then, yeah, maybe David could speak more to the actual materials that are in there.
Sure. I think it ended up there because when they created these regional archives, they created them for a good reason. It was a good idea, and that was stuff from around Southern California and should be in Southern California. Stuff from the Pacific Northwest should be up in Seattle. You can't have one in every city, but try to regionalize it. Now Hawaii's an outlier. So they put the Hawaii and the American Samoa records in the closest federal center they were going to create, which was San Francisco, which was a compromise. They matter for every citizen because all of us, ourselves and our ancestors, we deal with the federal government all the time. Right? You send a letter to legislators, you have an immigration record for yourself or an ancestor, you have a veteran record for you or an ancestor, you are, just to think about the kind of records that are there, Hawaii, you know, you have overthrow, You have annexation and occupation. You have the creation of statehood. You have one of the most important places in the military history of the United States. You have a hugely important place where all kinds of people who are coming in from Asia, many of them to work the plantations, are working and operating there. You have all the Kanaka, all the Native Hawaiians and their relations. So if you want to study your own family, if you want to study your community's history, if you want to study the history of veterans, of the military, of land, of law, there's different places you go. Sometimes you go to Honolulu, you go to State Archives, right? Which is right there on the Iolani Palace grounds. Sometimes you might go to Washington, D.C. But a lot of times you're going to go to the San Francisco Archives. And you have a right to do that, Addis, and Maile has a right to do that, and so do I. They're not available online. They've not been printed. There's millions and millions of pages. And you can't get to them unless you go there. And so it should be close. It should be free. It should be publicly available. These are our records. They belong to the citizens of the United States. They must be available to them. And they're making it harder to get to them or, for all we know, impossible. And we object to that. Is that fair, Maile?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe like from the scholarly perspective, it just puts a lot of scholars in a really bad place. For many folks, there's right now this flurry of, oh my gosh, I have to figure out how to get those records before they're gone or before we don't know what's going to happen to them, right? Which is a really just not a very good place for a lot of folks to be in and entirely unnecessary. If the National Archives, you know, has good reason to move or consolidate regional facilities, like, that's fine, but like there does need to be like clear public notice that ensures that people maintain access throughout the process or understand where these records are going and at what time. And so far, none of that has been made clear. That's what we object to.
I think that the point that you made, David, about a lot of people going through these archives to kind of learn more about their family history is really interesting, especially in relation to Hawaii and Hawaiian culture, because we do value knowing your mo'oku ʻauhau a lot here in the islands. I wanted to ask, are there any particularly important documents that are stored at NARA San Francisco that come to mind that if they are moved away from this facility and put under that kind of lock and key sort of surveillance that would heavily affect maybe the work you do or the work that your colleagues do?
The kinds of records that they have were maybe not originally intended for genealogical research, but because they are really well kept, like many other forms of federal data, like the census or the draft cards, right? Those have become really important ways for people today to trace and document and understand something about their own family, right? There are records related to individual people from Hawaii, maybe trying to go from the Hawaiian Kingdom into the United States and being denied, or there's immigration records that were not originally created to document genealogy, but have become an important source of genealogical research for people today because they're able to track their, oh, I know now that my great-great-grandfather tried to go to California in this year and was denied, or whatever it was in different people's personal circumstances. And this facility also has a lot of records related to Native American boarding schools. My research is right now is on the history of kind of similar institutions in Hawaii where they're really precursors to juvenile detention, but they were reformatories and industrial schools where children in Hawaii were sent to and they stayed at for years. So all those records, because they were created by those local entities, all the records mostly stayed here in Hawaii, right? But various people over time have been like, oh, I think I saw something related to those schools in these other archives all over the United States. And so I think one of my intentions was always to see if NARA San Francisco did have anything related to the schools I study. Again, that it kind of shows how this, where David and I aren't saying that it's important only to Hawaiians and Samoans. We know, we have seen other colleagues kind of raise awareness in their other communities, but we haven't seen as much awareness being raised here in Hawaii or among other Pacific Islanders.
Maile was talking about scholars who won't get access. That might sound maybe distant to some of your listeners, right? But the way the history that academic historians write is really for everybody. Right? It helps us to understand through the classes that we take, the classes that our teachers take that go on and teach our children, the history of Hawaii, the history of people's ancestors, the history of their lives. So all of this, it might seem far away from everyday life, but it's a way to everyday life. And that's our job. That's my job. That's Maile's job. When I think of National Archives research that has shaped the conversation in Hawaii perhaps more than anything else, I think of Noe Noe Silva's work when she studied and found the Kū'e petitions in the National Archives. Now, those specific petitions against the annexation of Hawaii into the United States, that those specific papers are sitting in Washington, D.C. But treasures like that also are sitting in San Francisco. And if we can't find those treasures, we can't bring them to people. We can't change the conversation.
You guys have mentioned that contained within these documents is a lot of evidence of what life was like during these very turbulent times in Hawaii's history. Apart from NARA San Francisco, is there a collection as expansive as this one or a collection that can give historians the same type of insight?
So there are pieces in Honolulu at the State Archives. There are pieces at NARA San Francisco. There are pieces in libraries. There are people's and people's family stories. And there's pieces in Washington, D.C. There's pieces in the newspaper. But unless we have all the pieces, we can't put together the puzzle.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Again, as David was framing this all, this is all about just like the rights of citizens, like to be able to research what happened.
One of the things I love so much about Hawaii and the Pacific is that people care so deeply about the past and they understand how much the past matters. Their own past of their own family, but also the past of the communities that they come from and that we live in today. And that connection to the past depends on access. And so that's one of the reasons that I think that there's such a strong reaction. And I think that I just want to kind of celebrate that in some ways. Another thing is just to really point out that it's not all personal information. Some of this is about public stories, and we're not seeing in recent years a government that's committed to openness. This matters a lot. It's making them under lock and key or just slowing down the access. It's making it more difficult in order to control the narrative. This is something I'm concerned about.
That was David Chang and Maile Arvin, the co-authors of a letter opposing the closure of NARA San Francisco. Interested in learning more about the archive? Check out hawaiipublicradio.org for more details later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Saturday night on The Real Deal, we'll get all ornithological as we celebrate the birthday of the bird, Charlie Parker, one of the most influential jazz musicians of all time. Join me, Seth Marco, Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR1 as we celebrate Charlie Parker.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute with courses for ages 50 and older at UH Manoa, community spaces, and online. Start September 28th, olliuhm.org.
A rare look into the physical history of one of the world's most active volcanoes is what this week's Volcano Minute brings. Here's Katie Mulliken from the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory.
Aloha, it's your weekly Volcano Minute brought to you by the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. In July of this year, scientists visited a rare window into Kilauea Volcano's long-term history. Layers of lava, ash, and other tephra exposed along the western wall of Kaluapele, the summit caldera, during the dramatic 2018 collapse. Because Kilauea is usually active, much of the surface is covered by young lava flows less than 1,000 years old. That makes these older deposits especially valuable. The 2018 collapse revealed sections of lava and tephra that hadn't been seen in over a century, since shortly after the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory was founded in 1912. After 2018, when Halemaumau Crater was much deeper, scientists first identified these deposits in the crater wall using aerial imagery. The crater floor has slowly risen as a result of eruptions since 2018, and scientists were finally able to examine one section of tephra layers in between lava fountaining episodes. Some of these layers could be thousands of years old and represent past Kilauea eruptions never before studied. Rising lava in Halemaumau has already reburied some of these exposures. Scientists will time their future visits between episodic lava fountaining activity so that they can collect other samples before the lava flows cover them again. Each sampling opportunity offers a rare chance to understand eruptions long lost to time. Most recently, Kilauea erupted episode 54 of lava fountaining at the summit for 9 hours on August 25th. Summit inflation has since resumed, indicating that another fountaining episode is possible and likely in the coming weeks. Mahalo for listening. I'm Katie Mulliken, and this was your weekly Volcano Minute brought to you by the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory.
You know, the Center for Oral History at UH Manoa recently landed more than $500,000 in new funding. It comes in a series of grants related to four projects. HPR has worked with the Center for Oral History on joint projects in the past, and we have highlighted some of those projects right here on The Conversation. We plan to continue that collaboration. HPR's Bill Dorman talked about the projects and the plans with Kunmiu Daniko, the director of the Center for Oral History at UH Manoa. It all started with a museum project done at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center with gallery director Jonathan Clark soon after the Maui fires of 2023, and with a question.
How do we co-create an exhibit where we talk about hopeful things? And so he created this great exhibit called Sense of Place, Place of Sense. And there we were able to create a little oral history box, had community come in and share their mo'olelos, as well as collecting some oral histories there. And then from there, we met other folks in the community who shared that it was important to preserve these histories and to remember what Maui was like. And then, so, yeah, I asked them, would it be helpful to pursue grants? And they said, absolutely. And so that's where it all started.
I was fortunate enough to see that exhibit, and that was such an inspiration because, as you say, it was such a heavy time, and yet it was an uplifting experience.
Absolutely. And I think the purpose was not to just remember Lahaina and Maui because of the mm-hmm. fires, mm-hmm. but to remember the people and yeah. the experience and the history and the stories that folks shared offered so much hope and resilience for the community. Yeah. It was a wonderful experience.
Now, four grants, one of them, Lahaina Memories, Preserving Oral Histories Through Intergenerational Storytelling.
As we do this, you know, I've now been here for 3 years, we get so many requests from folks to how do we do oral histories and how do we ensure that the younger generations, that the keikis, understand our history. Mm-hmm. And so this Lahaina Memories was really looking at, one, getting the community involved, those who want to be involved, mm-hmm. to train other kids how to do oral histories, to teach them how to do it. So the community themselves would collect oral histories. We're working with Lahaina Luna High School, and we're working with the Wailuku Public Library, and we're trying to work with community who feel like, okay, let's get folks to learn how to capture it. And so we're hoping about 60 oral histories will be captured from the communities. And then we will also be doing oral histories ourselves in the way that the center does it, based on the feedback from the community. So a couple weeks ago, Micah Mizukami, my associate director, and I went and met with community folks and just kind of shared who we are and what we've been doing and just getting input. What guides our oral history is always community input. So we don't just go out and pick people. Our community partners help us. And so yeah, it's going to be a wonderful process. It's going to be a two-year project.
One project, Echoes of Vai, Oral Histories from Maui. Vai, of course, water, which has always been so central to Maui in so many ways. Culture, conflict, power, and oral history.
Again, after the Lahaina fires, we had the privilege of reuniting with Kiamoku Kapu, who I knew in the 90s and got to meet him again. Strong, strong supporter of Aina, you know, Malama Aina, Aloha Aina, and especially around the issues around water and water activism. And he really taught me a lot in the 90s and continues to teach me. And we recognize it's such an important part of Hawaii's story, not just Maui, but all of the islands. Mm. And so with Tai Tengan, professor in ethnic studies, you know, and Alana Kalahele, graduate student in geography, who's also at the center, we all talked about what can we do. And so we proposed this NEH grant that we got taken away, but then we just got back. So we're really excited, but we think it's such a central core part of what we need to address when we look at climate change, climate justice, and water issues that affects all of us.
That theme of connection coming through with various work that you do at the Center for Oral History, and that's such a connection of community and connection of stories that's so important. And I'm thinking of your project, Nā Mo'olelo o Nā Wahine, a digital justice oral history project preserving Maui's Her Stories, clearly focusing on women and, in particular, women of color on Maui.
And, you know, I'm so grateful to the American Council of Learned Societies that gave us this wonderful grant. And this is looking at our existing archives. So, as you know, the Center for Oral History has over 1,200 oral histories. If you go up on our website and look under Scholar Space. And we have many projects on Maui. But one of the things that I often notice is that I think women do so much. And not that men don't, but women do a lot. And I really wanted to highlight it. So we're looking at our existing archive materials, and we're going to digitize this. And, you know, excited to be working with Hawaii Public Radio.
I was going to say, this is a project that we're involved with as well, and look forward to
Yeah, we're thrilled that we get to work with you again. And working and highlighting the key, like Pioneer Mill or some of the plantation stories or Lahaina Luna borders, even some parts from the MAC as well, some recent ones, but collecting and activating, you know, the stories of women who have made such a difference, small and big, in ways that are meaningful to preserving our history and highlighting some of the pukas in our histories that people don't know about.
And the nature of oral history is such that once you get people sit and talk story, other things come out and other paths sort of open up in terms of exploration, in terms of looking at history in different ways.
And one of the wonderful things about oral histories, families and narrators will share photos, you know, and share artifacts from their families and triggers memories too as they're sharing these photos. And we're, you know, invited into their homes, so grateful. And I said this to you before too, is that every time we do an oral history, I really feel gifted. I feel that I'm opening up a box of gifts and I'm learning and building these relationships with our community members that I treasure. And that one that is a keepsake for sure. It's not something, a gift that you put aside, but it's a gift that you really treasure and value. And so I'm so grateful to our community to be a part of this.
You know, another project, this one's not tied to Maui, but you have a museum exhibit coming up in Incheon, South Korea. Talk about that.
Yeah. So in 2024, you know, shortly after I started, I visited Honouliuli because we had an existing partnership with the National Park Services. And from there, I learned as I was touring and looking at the old internment camp that 2,700 of the people who inhabited Honouliuli were Korean prisoners of war. The two largest were Okinawan prisoners of war and Korean prisoners of war. And so I just said, hey, what's their story? You know, what's going on? And so at the time, the person who was managing it said, hey, yeah, let's go ahead and try to apply for a grant. And so I've been interviewing descendants of the Korean POWs. And it's been incredible because of my own family background. I'm learning a lot about Korean history that I had no idea before. And so then I went to the Museum of Korean Emigration in Incheon and noticed that they had a great exhibit about Hawaii, Koreans in Hawaii. Yet there was no mention of the Koreans in Hawaii who had relationships with these Korean POWs. And so we talked about it, shared our research, and I guess they really loved it. And so we're doing an exhibit that opens September 22nd at the Museum of Korean Emigration in Incheon, and it will run to February of 2027.
You know, I've got to ask also about the nature of grants. And I know federal funding is something that you have had and then was taken away, some you've gotten back. But how do you look a bit differently, perhaps, at the funding mechanism involved in something like oral history and preserving and obtaining and producing and all of that?
Yeah, I think there's so much that goes into oral history preservation and collection work that folks are not aware of. And so thank you for asking that question. And as we know, grants for humanities have been cut short. We're lucky for Hawaii Community Foundation to give us Lahaina Memories grant. That's a really significant one. But in all, it's really hard to find. And so one of the things that we're doing is we established an endowment. And it's named after Warren Nishimoto and Michiko Kodama Nishimoto, who were directors and research associates for almost 40 years, you know, over 30 years. And they collected at the time about 800 oral histories all over the islands. Incredible people, incredible work. And I'm so thankful to call them mentors and friends. And not to also mention Chad Taniguchi, who at age 24 was the first PI for the Oral History Project. But in the memory of Warren and Michi's dedication and hard work, and they're still very much alive and with us, we established an endowment in their name. And so we're hoping to build enough where we don't have to rely on grants so we can do the oral histories our ways. Of everyday Hawaii's people as it was intended, not just the rich and popular and famous, but everyday folks who have made such a significant impact on our histories and our lives. And we continue to benefit from that. So, yeah, we're hoping that folks can join in and support the Center for Oral History as we try to reach 1,200 folks to give by October 16th.
That was Kunmi Yudaniko, director of the Center for Oral History at Manoa, talking with HPR's Bill Dorman. The center celebrates its 50th anniversary in October. That wraps it up for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, concerns are growing over the news that the federal government has just purchased $16 million worth of shock gloves for ICE agents to use. What do you think? Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Our program is produced by Jacob Aloy, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen. Our intern is Addis Belay. Additional support from the HPR digital team. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow. Pick up the conversation.